Well, thank the organizing committee and Jane in particular for asking me to do this. I've never seen an enthusiasm graph, and Sylvia and I actually appreciated that, and I just probably better let you know up front that my enthusiasm for perennial grasses is a bigger bubble than it is for miscanthus. Well, I guess miscanthus is a perennial too, but my enthusiasm bubble. Okay, but just so that you know though, but I have a bigger bubble for these grasses, so you'll know my bias, I guess, up front. Should acknowledge up front the people who have helped in this presentation, and obviously we all have that situation where we're all being aided and working collaboratively with many other people. Perhaps this bubble part kind of fits in right here. I thought I would share with you a quote from Wendell Berry that he wrote in the foreword to the Grassland book that came out last year as a sequel, I guess, if you want to call it that, to the 40 years of the grassland, 40 years in agriculture, whatever it was called, from 1960. And he said, "And so I am, and for all I know genetically, a lover of grass, or to be more precise, I am a lover of sod, a compound organism consisting of topsoil covered by growing plants and held together by perennial roots, populated by grasses, legumes, weeds, many of which are palatable or inoffensive and beautiful, birds, animals, bugs, worms, and tons of invisible soil organisms. A good sod, healthy and not overgrazed, is a sponge, gathering the rain, holding it, releasing it slowly. It is kind to the land it grows on, kind to the local watershed, kind to the people and other creatures downstream. Land under a healthy, well-kept sod is safe. It will grow richer and healthier year after year. It is not going to wash away. A farmer whose fields are well-sodded will wake in the night, hear the hard rain coming down, and go comfortably back to sleep." Now, we had so much rain in South Dakota this year that I don't know if many of them actually fell comfortably back to sleep, but that can happen at times. I guess my talk is outlined maybe a little bit differently, and I've tried to attend as many of these symposia talks as I could, just so that I would try not to repeat the same thing that somebody else might have said, and I'm sure we'll do some of that. But if I'm going to talk about some of these things that are on this slide, not all of them, but some of the potential positive impacts that I see from for these herbaceous perennials, this is going to be limited mostly to the native C4 grasses. Not that that's all the ones that exist, obviously, but that's what most of this talk will be about. But they are perennial, and so that's one major advantage. And the first slide that I'll show you after this is going to talk to that to some extent. We do typically recognize that they have a need for a lower chemical inputs. And I really appreciated the talks throughout the various symposia that about nitrogen in particular, and I'll talk about that a little bit from these grasses. A little bit about manure. I'm not really going to talk about nitrogen fixation by legumes, but as a perennial, obviously we have to have that in our minds. The productivity, I'm not going to talk about that too much per se, a little bit, but not so much comparing species and so forth, but a little bit about that. And I'll spend some time at the end looking at some of these ecosystem services that are hard to quantify, I guess, sometimes as far as an economic value, but some of them we can do that. And then finally, this whole idea of suitability on marginal land, and I'm always interested whenever anybody uses the term marginal land, because sometimes it means different things to different people. It's a little bit like sustainability. And so I hopefully can show you a couple things on some what would be obviously marginal land and what might work there and how we see these perennial grasses or how I see these perennial grasses fitting into that kind of a system. So getting to this idea of perenniality, I guess, is a critical thing up front. This is some work that we did back in the early part of this decade. And if there were a take-home message, maybe there's a couple of take-home messages here. One thing that Sylvie said that I thought was very good, among other things, obviously, too, Sylvie, but was that obviously if we're taking nitrogen off, we've got to replace that somehow, or somehow that's got to come back into the system. In eastern South Dakota, where this data comes from, if you look at total yield, and this was a study where we harvested either at anthesis, so that's what the AN stands for, which would be at peak biomass, for us that'd be sometime in August, or we waited until after a killing frost, and that would be this right-hand set of bars. And this would be total yield, or this would just be the switchgrass yield. So this was a switchgrass stand that had been in switchgrass since 1975. In CRP from 1982 to 1995, if I remember correctly. You can see that in general, our yields are not high across these three locations. We had some drought issues that went on here. We're about 1,000 kilograms per hectare. We had some other times where we were approaching this, 4.5 to 5.5 megagrams per hectare. The take-home message on this one, however, is two things: is that number one, our yields are lower than some other places, like in the South, for example. The other very important part of this is that if we don't manage this stand properly, even in a stand that was 25 years old when we began to work on it, that we can kill it very quickly if we harvest it at the wrong time for us. That meant that these plots right here, and this is why you see these yields go down in these anthesis harvests the second year of measurements, that we now have a stand basically made up of foxtail barley and no switchgrass. So this center aisle here was harvested at anthesis during those 4 year periods, whereas the stuff on the side would have been harvested at a later period, so that we could have some recycling of nutrients back into the roots and rhizomes and allow that to provide some of the needs for the next year's growth as well. We have to have it be perennial. This whole idea of location, 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 or yield is critical. From a pesticide use standpoint, Singer et al. Had published this, a table where they had looked at the total pounds or kilograms of active ingredient of all the different kinds of pesticides, herbicides, insecticides, and fungicides used in the U.S. in 2004. 69% of those were used on corn, cotton, soybean, and wheat in that year. Now, I'm a pretty pragmatic person. I'm an optimist, but I guess I'm pragmatic too. I understand that we have needs for herbicides, pesticides on these native perennial grasses as well, but we do recognize that their primary use is this for herbicides, especially is during this year of establishment. When we're somewhat challenged getting them going sometimes their maintenance for so we can kind of reduce their use. And then again in the past, it's not said so often now, but in the past people might say that we really didn't have any insect or pest problems with on something like switchgrass, but we know that we do. I mean, it's kind of silly to think otherwise. I mean, they've evolved in this area and the pests have evolved with them. Getting to this idea of nitrogen, this was part of that same study from before, and this is the study from Vogel and others from Nebraska and Iowa. In this study, what we saw, and we had nitrogen application rates that varied from zero up to a split application of 224 kilograms per hectare. And what we saw, and even though none of these were significant, this is total yield over here on the left. This right set of bars is just switchgrass. So after we had taken out any of the weedy species, legumes or broadleaves or grassy weeds, what was the yield of the switchgrass? And what we saw is that there was this tendency for increased yield as fertilizer rate went up to 56 kilograms per hectare. But beyond that, we really didn't see a response, and statistically it was not significant even at 56, but there was that tendency for it to go up. And I believe that that's real, that with the yields that we were seeing in this 3,000 or 4,000 kilogram per hectare, when we're taking these off at about now, late October, early November, our nitrogen content in the plant is less than 1%. Always it has been. It's usually down around 0.5 to 0.6%. So there's not a lot of nitrogen being taken off the field at that point. Vogel and others in this study had used a two-cut system, and because of that, one cut was taken early in the summer, and then a second cut was taken after a killing frost. And so they had said that they had recommended that for those areas and in that harvest management system, that about 120 kilograms of nitrogen was going to be required for those systems. And that makes sense if you think about it from a removal standpoint, number one, because of when it was harvested the first time and then what happened thereafter. And so this kind of fits. And so when we, just as the previous speaker said, when they're harvested and how we manage them is going to have a big impact. If we look at this same kind of data, this is from some CRP work, or land that was basically like CRP. It was hunting land, but it was in native warm season grass mixtures. We saw a similar response. At one location, we saw no response to nitrogen. At the other location, once we got up to 56 kilograms per hectare, things leveled out. And this makes sense even again when we see the yields that we're dealing with. We've done some work with manure, and I think from an environmental standpoint, it's important to consider the effect that the ability that we have to use manure on these native grasses. I mean, it works very well on them. And in the interest of time, I better speed up here a little bit, actually. But what we did is we had gone out and we put on here's our control. This is some work that Do-kyung Lee, who was a student at SDSU, did. Compared 112 or 224 kilograms of ammonium nitrate fertilizer to 112, the equivalent in manure of 112 or 224 kilograms of nitrogen in manure. And what we saw, again, this is the total yield, so that would include weedy species, and here's our switchgrass yields. And this is in a two-year cycle because we had every year and every other year harvests going on here, and so that's averaged across that treatment. And what you see is again, we had decent yields, very respectable yields in some cases, but the manure at the end of the second two-year cycle. So this is a four-year study, but the end of the second two-year cycle, despite the fact that it was not significant statistically, it tended to have a higher yield, and the manure tended to work out better on these plots. Now, part of that came about, and I apologize for all the numbers on this slide, but I draw your attention perhaps over to the right-hand side over here. These are the plots down here. These abbreviations, this stands for switchgrass, grassy weeds, and broadleaf weeds. And so we also wanted to see what happened to these plots as we went over time. And so after 4 years, if you look through here, the grassy weed here's the switchgrass percent, 61.5%, and the zero nitrogen, basically the same in the manure-treated plots, about a third lower in those plots that had received ammonium nitrate. And as a consequence, obviously, the inverse is true for the grassy weeds and the broadleaf weeds. Now, part of that is because of our harvest management, obviously. That's coming into play here as well, that anthesis harvest allows more weeds to come in. But it was still interesting that despite that the grassy weeds stayed down a little bit better when we use manure. And our theory there was because of the slower release of the nitrogen that it was able to the plants were able to make better use of it. Whoop. From a water quality standpoint, just one slide here, some data from Randall and Mula in 2001 from Minnesota, where they looked at water that came out of drain tiles under various systems and the nitrate-nitrogen content on a kilogram per hectare basis that would have come out of there. Here's continuous corn, obviously very high, corn, soybean very high, alfalfa or CRP, basically almost no nitrate-nitrogen coming out of that water. Soil carbon storage, a lot of work done on this, and I almost didn't include this because I knew that there would be a lot of talk about this at this symposium, and it actually, quite frankly, it kind of scared me to talk to maybe a soil scientist here and me talking about soil carbon sequestration, but I decided to put this in here anyway. This is the same work that Lee et al. In South Dakota did, and what they found, what he found, is that under the zero nitrogen control, so this is a 25-year-old switchgrass stand, in the control there was no increase in carbon down to 90 centimeter depth. With that manure application, the carbon during that four-year period went up by 4 megagrams carbon per hectare per year. Under the ammonium nitrate, and this kind of fits with what Sylvia was saying, about 2.5 megagrams carbon per hectare per year. In North Dakota, much higher rates, about 10 megagrams carbon per hectare per year on a switchgrass stand. And then in the work that just was wonderful work on these field scale trials, and another thing to promote this idea of field scale, in this field scale work that was published by the Liebig et al., down to 120 centimeter depth, they saw about 3 megagrams carbon per hectare per year coming up across those 10, on average, coming adding that much carbon into the soil profile over that, I think it was a five-year study. This is just from the Liebig's work, and this is the Bristol, South Dakota site. And I brought in one of their graphs just to show that there was a lot of variability. This is the as they started the study, the yellow bar would be the baseline soil carbon measurements in the soil. The blue bar would be the soil carbon that had come in at the end of the five-year study. And it's hard to see this. A lot of these are not actually, the p-value is not significant, but in almost every case, there was an increase in carbon down at those depths, and you see that at these ones in North Dakota as well. Now, finally, one of the things that I really haven't heard mentioned in any of the talks thus far is one ecosystem service that's very important, obviously, in South Dakota is wildlife habitat. One of the reasons for that is because if you've ever been to South Dakota and you fly into South Dakota in Sioux Falls, if you fly into Sioux Falls in the month of October, basically you have shotgun shells and everything else that you could want that are being sold in the airport. We're low on security but high on killing pheasants. and so you can buy any of that that you want in the airport as you come off the plane. It's a very important industry for us, and some of these native grasses are very important to us. And I bring this up, and I'm talking about the overwintered biomass in this case because there's an important component there that's associated with wildlife habitat. And if you look at some of the work that we've done, we've looked at big blue stem switchgrass and intermediate wheatgrass where we've done harvest management on it, where we harvested in the summer, the fall, or allowed it to overwinter, and then measured yield on that. And I'll show some data on that in a second. And then Adler and others in Pennsylvania had done some of this work as well. And in their paper, they mentioned the whole idea of having some wildlife habitat over the cold winter months. And this picture just kind of demonstrates what can happen. This is overwintered blue stem in the foreground, overwintered switchgrass in the background. Now, obviously, there's loss of both. But obviously, again, the switchgrass is much more able to withstand the rigors of winter than the big blue stem would be. And I had to throw this in there, same slide, except for this is South Dakota's crop right here. Well, I'm running out of time. So with them and deer, they're a very important component of the whole system. We like this because this is what provides the habitat for the pheasants or other birds over the winter, and then the switchgrass can kind of come back up. In the data of Adler et al., they did see about a 40% yield reduction over the course of the winter, or if they allowed it to overwinter, and that was at a field scale, and I think that's critical because ours wasn't. And so that's real, and they had much more snow than we did. For us, we actually, by cutting shorter, we cut it about 6 inches taller, 15 centimeters in the fall, and then in the spring, rather than cutting that high because we're no longer worried about having the stubble, we'd cut it down as short as we could get the cutter to go, and we were able to kind of compensate for the yield, the senescence issue, and compensate for that by cutting to a shorter height, leaving a less of a stubble. I'm going to run through this a little bit quick. This is some work that we have in northeastern South Dakota, and I wanted to provide this kind of bird's eye view. And when we talk about marginal land, this is a switchgrass trial, a 24-acre switchgrass trial that we have. You can see nitrogen treatments maybe going across here, the strips of that are darker green. This is important because when we look at what we call marginal land, all of these low spots are relatively wet, and we have to be careful with what we do there. This is not the same picture, but when we talk about marginal land, we look at species that we know that we can fit into this, and one of those is prairie cordgrass. This is a stand of prairie cordgrass that grows along the river, and then coming up into this farmer's field, we have soybeans. This is that stand a year later. Now, that's marginal. And so, you know, we can do some of these things, but we can't always, well, we can never manage the nature. I want to talk about field scale to a certain extent. I wish that we could have people up here, instead of me speaking, a farmer like Roger Locken that we work with, because these are the people that really have the boots on the ground, they understand their systems, and they know what they want to put in places. This is a man who is, he's irrigating back here, you really can't see the center pivot, and down here, here's his 10 or 15 acre prairie cordgrass stand that he has there just to kind of manage the water situation. And then finally, maybe I'll just run through a couple things here. How many more minutes? One minute. All right. This is some pictures of the EcoSun Prairie Farm that we work on south of Brookings, so in eastern part of South Dakota. It's about a section of land, so about 640 acres, that is being, it's in the process of being converted from row crop land primarily to a prairie grass farm, basically. Part of that obviously meant that some of these wetlands have been restored. We put prairie cordgrass into those. This would be the year of transplanting. This is the fall after they've been transplanted, and this is prairie cordgrass the following spring. Now, the really key point here, and this is the reason I show this from a marginal land standpoint, is that just as all of you in your areas, I'm sure, have this, we have a lot of these areas in fields, like these kidney wetlands, that are unfarmable most years. And so we look at fitting the species to the landscape as being a really critical part of managing the environmental implications of these species. And by bringing something in there in here like prairie cordgrass, for example, that can work in those areas, that helps us take advantage of land that truly, truly is marginal. And then as a good consequence, we actually are bringing in waterfowl and other wildlife that either have not been there or have not been there in the quantities that they are now by bringing in some of these species. So I'll conclude with that, I guess, and turn it back over, Jane.